For the last time, Exodus 20 and verse 3, and by now hopefully you've got it memorized. Exodus 20 and verse 3 says, "You shall have no gods besides me or before me." This will be the first commandment, part 10. In this series of messages, or I should say this series of messages, has been primarily a study of the statute, or the statutes which help explain and help us to understand what the first commandment is really all about. Thus far, we've examined four different statutes that come under this first commandment as found in Exodus 20. Before leaving this commandment, there is one more statute which I believe needs to be addressed as well, as found in Deuteronomy chapter 4. If you'll turn there, Deuteronomy chapter 4, and specifically verse 19. Deuteronomy 4, verse 19, it says, "And beware lest you lift up your eyes to heaven and see the sun and the moon and the stars, all the host of heaven, and be drawn away and worship them and serve them, those which Yahweh your God has allotted to all the peoples under the whole heaven." There in this particular statute, again, it's found in this particular verse, we are specifically commanded not to worship the host of heaven. That's specifically what it says, the sun, the moon, and the stars, the host of heaven. We're not to bow down to them and literally worship them. But I believe, matter of fact, I'm convinced, I'm sure, that this statute is found in this verse, that it would also apply to the animals, to any animal, bird, reptile, or fish of the earth as well. I'm convinced of that because primarily because of the previous verses that precede verse 19. Starting with verse 15, it says, "So watch yourselves carefully, since you did not see any form on the day Yahweh spoke to you at Horeb from the midst of the fire, lest you act corruptly and make a graven image for yourself in the form of any figure, the likeness of male or female." And then verse 17, "The likeness of any animal that is on the earth, the likeness of any winged bird that flies in the sky, the likeness of anything that creeps on the ground, the likeness of any fish that is in the water below the earth." And then it goes right on into verse 13, where we are not to worship the host of heaven at all. Now, verses 15 through 18 very clearly is specifically dealing with idolatry, which comes under the second commandment, not the first. But not only are we not to make graven images of these things, but obviously we're not to literally worship the literal thing either. And that's why, again, it flows right into the host of heaven. In broader terminology, we're not to worship anything which has been created in substitution for the Creator. The Apostle Paul, I believe in reiteration of this very statute, identifies such behavior as falling for the lie. In Romans chapter 1, if you'd like to turn there. Romans chapter 1, beginning with verse 18. It says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over in the lust of their hearts to impurity, that their bodies might be dishonored among them. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie," or the footnote in my Bible says, "the lie. For they exchanged the truth of God for the lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen." They worshipped the creature rather than the Creator. In the rest of this chapter, Paul goes on and outlines that outlines such apostasy as being the root cause for the moral decay, specifically homosexuality, for being the root cause for the moral decay of any nation. That is, breaking the first commandment, worshiping the creature rather than the Creator. Now, what I want to do with at least the first part of this message is look at some modern day applications of this statute. And normally I think we'd maybe read Deuteronomy 4 and verse 19, we'd think, well, there's really not that much to apply, Deuteronomy 4 and 19 too. We're going to look at some modern-day applications, and I've divided them into three categories: the obvious, the not-so-obvious, and the obscure applications for this passage. Let's begin with the obvious. And what I want to do is let me read from my notes Deuteronomy 4 and verse 19 again, and I want you to tell me what one might consider as an obvious application of this verse. Deuteronomy 4 and verse 19, it says, "And beware lest you lift up your eyes to heaven and see the sun and the moon and the stars, all the host of heaven, and be drawn away and worship them and serve them." What do you think is an obvious application of that statute for today? Horoscopes. Astrology. I think anybody would see that. And I think probably they would read Deuteronomy 4:19 and they say, that's what that deals with, exclusively. Well, it certainly deals with astrology, and let there be no doubt. Astrologers, or those adherents to it, such as Ronald and Nancy Reagan, are condemned by God. Now, somebody says, well, astrology isn't mentioned there. Well, it is in Isaiah chapter 47. Isaiah chapter 47, verses 13 and 14. I think I got the, Isaiah 47, starting with verse 13. It says, "You are wearied with your many counsels. Let now the astrologers, those who prophesy by the stars," or some King James, I believe, uses stargazers, "those who predict by the new moons, stand up and save you from what will come upon you." Verse 14, behold, now it's obviously being sarcastic here. Let them stand up. Let them save you from all that's coming down upon you. You think they're going to save us today with all that's coming down upon us today? If they're your gods, if they are who you believe in, let them save you is the point. He's being sarcastic. Verse 14, "Behold, they have become like stubble. Fire burns them. They cannot deliver themselves from the power of the flame. There will be no coal to warm by, no fire to sit before." You might also ask, who or what's the fire? Who do the Scriptures identify the fire as being? A remnant in this day and age of Israel. Those who have come to Christ will be the fire that burns up not only Edom, but those who are idolaters and First Commandment transgressors as well. So astrologers very clearly are being condemned here and will be eventually destroyed if they don't repent of their ways. Astrology is First Commandment transgression according to the statute found in Deuteronomy 4 and verse 19. That's the obvious, and I expected at least somebody to come up with that. I was at least hoping you would, or I was going to mess up my whole message here. But now let's talk about the not so obvious, maybe something that you wouldn't normally quite think of as being an application of this particular statute. Now keep in mind that this statute found in Deuteronomy 4 and verse 19 would apply to anything created by God, the worship of anything created by God. Consequently, we could also apply it to the worship of gold and silver. Okay, that's something created by God. Now, keep in mind, it would not apply to the worship of Federal Reserve notes, because that's not the creation of God, is it? That's the creation of man. And that's the difference between the First Commandment and the Second Commandment, is that the Second Commandment of idolatry deals with worshiping the creation of man. Quote unquote, man can't create anything but that which he thinks he creates. And of course, Federal Reserve notes certainly haven't been created, because they've tried to create something out of nothing. But nonetheless, you get the point, is that idolatry is the worship of that which man, quote unquote, creates, whereas First Commandment transgression is the worship of those things which the Creator, God, has created. Consequently, the worship of silver and gold, at least in this day and age, is not too big of a problem with Israel. You know why? Well, because somebody has stole all the gold and silver from Israel. They don't have it anymore. They can't worship it. But, at least in this area, the problem Israel has is the problem of idolatry, which is in the next series to come sometime. And that's the worship of the Federal Reserve notes. And certainly we worship the Federal Reserve, don't we, in this day and age? People don't know it, but they certainly do. And that's idolatry. On the other hand, those who stole the gold and the silver have a problem with First Commandment transgression. And let me prove the point to you. I received this probably 4 or 5 years ago, and I just put it in a file because I knew that I'd probably sometime want to use it in a message. What it is, you can see it's a nicely made-up packet. It's from the Weizmann Institute of Science, and it's a tribute to Meyer Weizgall. And what they had is they had this great big meeting at the Weizmann Center for this man in tribute to him, and they had songs that they sang, and they had a great big dinner and all that went with it. Well, I want to read to you. I wish I had the music to it, because I'm sure it would have this Jewish beat to it, you know. But I don't have the music. But everybody, obviously, the music isn't there, so obviously everybody knew this song that attended this tribute. And it was a song that, it was one of those types that certain ones would sing a part of it, and then the crowd would all join in the chorus. Listen to this. It's called "The Dance Around the Golden Calf." Now, in this case, the golden calf doesn't mean the idol. It means gold, as you're going to see in the song itself. Listen to this song that these people, who we know stole the gold, for the most part, we know who runs the Federal Reserve, we know who the Weizmann Center is, and we know what race Meyer Weizgall is, and it's their song. Listen to this song. I read this for the first time. I couldn't believe that they would be this bold about who their God really is. "The Dance Around the Golden Calf." Chorus. "This is a God who has led us in triumph, and from the desert will lead us soon." Talking about not the desert then, but the desert now they feel they're in. "And from the desert will lead us soon. So bring him tribute amid rejoicing, encircling dance and playing of harps. This is the God who leads us onward, and from the desert set us free. This is a God. This is a God. This is a homely God. A God who is like us." That's interesting. "A God of gold and no God of soul. This is a homely God, a God of gold, a God who is like us, no God of soul." Then it has for the angels to sing. I guess that's whoever's leading it. "Now get thee down, look on thy folk. Now get thee down and see thy folk. Now get thee down and see thy folk." Chorus again. "This is a God, this is a God, a God of gold, a God of gold. So bring him tribute amid rejoicing, encircling dance and playing of harps. This is a God who has led us in triumph, and from the desert will lead us soon. This is a God. This is a homely God. This is a shining God. This is a kindly God." Their God is a God of gold. At least one of their gods. We're going to find out that they have another God as well. But one of their gods is a God of gold. And thus those who stole the gold from Israel have a problem with First Commandment disobedience in this regards. You know, Job understood that the worship of silver and gold, the creation of God, was First Commandment transgression, because he put the two in the same category. That is, he put the worship of the heavenly hosts, the sun, the moon, and the stars, and gold and silver in the same category. Turn to Job chapter 31. Job 31, starting with verse 24. Job says, "I have put my confidence in gold and have called fine gold my trust." Or excuse me, let me start again. "If I have put my confidence in gold and called fine gold my trust, if I have gloated because my wealth was great and because my hand had secured so much, if I have looked at the sun when it shone or the moon going in splendor and my heart became secretly enticed and my hand threw a kiss from my mouth, that too would have been an iniquity calling for judgment, for I would have denied God above." And so we can see that this statute not only just applies to the heavenly host, but to anything, even inanimate objects like gold and silver, or any other possessions that God has created that we might secure to ourselves that we become worshipers of. A note in Matthew 6 and verse 24, Christ himself said, "No one can serve two masters. For you'll either hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." The contrast is made between God and mammon. And consequently, if you serve mammon, you have made mammon your master or your God. And thus, again, it very clearly can become a god. And how similar that verse, as found in Matthew 6:24, is to Elijah's question put before the people in 1 Kings 18 and verse 21, where he said, "How long will you hesitate between two opinions? If Yahweh is God, follow him. But if Baal," or in this case, if mammon, riches, gold, silver, is God, serve it. Very similar verses. Not only applied to Baal, you see, mammon, gold and silver, can become, it's not only something that can be formed into an idol, but can become a god in and of itself, can become a Baal to us. Here's another area that may be categorized as the not so obvious, though it wouldn't have surprised me if someone wouldn't have also came up with this as one of the obvious, but probably more so in the not so obvious category. How about the evolutionists? Doesn't the evolutionist worship the creature rather than the creator, or that created rather than the creator? Turn to Psalms 106. Psalms 106, verses 19 and 20. Listen, speaking about Israel of old and their transgression, verse 19 says, "They made a calf in Horeb and worshipped a molten image." Idolatry in this case. But then verse 20, it says, "Thus they exchanged their glory for the image of an ox that eats grass." Now, in light of that, recall what the Apostle Paul wrote again in Romans 1, verses 22 and 23. He said, "Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for the image in the form of corruptible man, of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures." Here in Psalms, in this case we don't know if it was David or not, but whoever was the writer, he said that they exchanged the glory of God for that of a calf which eats grass. You know, we should be, in other words, they exchanged the glory of God, the Creator, for that of cattle created by God, which eats grass created by God. I want you to get the point of that. You know, and we should probably be thinking to ourselves, you know, how stupid can people be to exchange the glory of God, the Creator, for a cow that eats grass? But you know what? The modern-day evolutionist goes them one better. They've digressed even further. You see, whereas Israel worshipped cows, the evolutionist worships the apes. Cows eat grass. Have you ever been to a zoo and saw what seen what apes eat? Probably have. I think you know what I'm talking about without getting too explicit here. I mean, they worship cows that eat grass, and the evolutionist eats apes, which eat something else. You know, they've digressed even further. Here's a poster. Bob, would you come up here and help me spread this out? I apologize for those who will hear this on tape because the poster really, I can't do justice to this poster. But here's a great poster of exactly how far they've digressed. What it is, it's a poster of the supposed missing links of the fictional chain, the fictional evolutionary chain of mankind. So it begins and it goes through each of those evolutionary quote-unquote missing links. Starting off on the left side is Heidelberg Man, and underneath it says, "Built from a jawbone that was connected by, which was conceded by many to be quite human." And again, the pictures do this so well. The next one is the Nebraska Man that they picture, scientifically built up from one tooth that and later found to be the tooth of an extinct pig. Piltdown Man, the jawbone turned out to belong to a modern ape. The next is Peking Man, 500,000 years old. All evidence has disappeared. Neanderthal Man, an International Congress of Zoology in 1958. Dr. A.J. E. Cave said that his examination of the famous Neanderthal skeleton found in France over 50 years ago is that of an old man who suffered from arthritis. The next is Cro-Magnon Man. One of the earliest and best established fossils is at least equal in physique and brain capacity to modern man, so what's the difference? And then the next picture is that of modern man. And I have to describe this one. He's standing in a hole that he's dug, and he's lifting up the skull of a supposed ape to an idol of an ape eating a banana with "Our Father?" question mark underneath. And it says, "Modern man, this genius, thinks he came from a monkey." And then it ends with Romans 1:22, "Professing themselves to be wise, they certainly became fools." That certainly depicts it well, where evolutionists stand today, where they've become, again, worshipers of the created rather than that of the Creator. You know, when you get right down to it, though, it's even worse than that for the evolutionist. Because they not only worship apes, but when you really boil it all down, they've even digressed even further, for they really worship the amoeba. I mean, you want to talk about stupidity. I don't know about you, but I have no ambitions to ever worship an amoeba. I don't know about you or not, but I certainly do not. And I've got almost a poster, a big Frank and Ernest cartoon that I think really depicts this well. It begins on the left with this particular one, with an amoeba in the water, which turns into a fish, which turns into an amphibian, which turns into a reptile, which turns into a monkey crossed with something else. And the monkey crossed with something else turns into a monkey, which then turns into the caveman, which then turns into the spear chucker, which then turns into Frank and Ernest. And then the next frame, the last frame, says, "Proceed at own risk." And isn't that so true? If it's left up to us, you know, look at the things that have been left up to us when we haven't done it God's way. And we think we're going to go further in life and become something better than what God Himself made us to be. You know, here's what it really is in a nutshell. I was a tadpole when I began to begin. Next, I was a frog with my tail tucked in. Then I was a monkey in a coconut tree. And now I'm a man with a PhD. You know, I think Paul really understood what he was talking about when he said, professing to become wise, these great PhDs, they became fools, plain and simple. And not only that, they became first commandment transgressors. Then, of course, we have humanism. Well, what is it that the humanists, what created thing do they worship? Well, mankind, humankind, human being, of course. Webster's New International Dictionary defines humanism in this way. It defines it as a contemporary cult or belief calling itself religious, but substituting faith in man for faith in God. Then later it says, faith in the supreme value of self-perfectibility of human personality, end quote. Their definition of humanism. Let's get it from their own mouths, though. Excuse me, from the Humanist Manifesto 1, plank number 6, it says, we are convinced that the time has passed for theism, or for belief in God. And then in Humanist Manifesto number 2, in tenet number 1, paragraph number 2, it says, we find insufficient evidence for belief in the existence of a supernatural. Of course, Paul addressed that. He says, it's all around you, you idiots. And everything I created testifies that I am. I mean, these guys really prove just what Paul talks about. They're fools. They're idiots. And then in paragraph 4, it says, no deity will save us. We must save ourselves. And then in the conclusion of Humanist Manifesto 2, it says, at the present juncture of history, commitment to all mankind is the highest commitment to which we are capable. It transcends the narrow allegiances of church, state, party, class, or race in moving toward a wider vision of human potentiality. That's their greatest allegiance to mankind. They've said it themselves. You know, I see the humanist as even more stupid, more foolish than the evolutionist, because with some of them, they have totally turned it around. Plato, for example, said this. He said he was a wise man who invented God. Totally turns it around. In other words, he was saying that God is merely the figment of man's imagination. And he called it wisdom. And yet contrast that with what David said on the other hand in Psalms 14:1, when he said, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And if he's just the figment of man's imagination, then he has said, there is no God. Recall again also what Paul said. Again, he said, they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. What lie? And again, footnote says, the lie. What lie? The granddaddy of all lies. The lie that originated in the garden when Satan, the adversary, promised to mankind that they could be gods. That's the lie. That they or any other created thing could be a god. You see, evolution is not a theory. It's not even a hypothesis when you really get right down to it. It's not even something new. Darwin didn't come up with it. It's just a lie. almost as old as time itself. Just a lie. And then also Paul went on to say, or he continued to say, professing to be wise, they became fools and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator. They were fools. It's not wisdom to create the idea of God, because if you create it, there never has been no such thing. There is no such thing as God Himself as a real being. It's foolish. Jeremiah, or Yahweh, in Jeremiah 17:5 said, "Cursed is the man who trusts in mankind and makes flesh his strength, and whose heart turns away from Yahweh." Cursed is the man. The humanists say, no deity can save us. We will save ourselves. Yeah, you think so. God says, cursed you will be, and cursed they will be, because God has stated it so. And then we come to the obscure. Those are things, and there may be others that maybe could be applied that I haven't thought of, that could be in the not so obvious. But now let's talk about those things that I doubt very few, if any, people would ever think of, applying Deuteronomy 4 and verse 19 to the obscure application. Now keep in mind again that when we break this statute, anytime we worship anything created by God, the worship of it breaks this statute. How about this one? How about animal right activists? Think they fit under that statute? How about them? Animal right activists who are nearly always more concerned about whales, fish, crabs, owls, seals, etc., than they are over the murder of human babies. Now, they become, in so doing, First Commandment transgressors. And I'm sure somebody's going to say, well, how is that First Commandment transgression? Well, remember that when we break Yahweh's commandments, we have, in essence, begun to worship another god. Because we prove who is our God by whom we obey. And when we disobey Yahweh, the God of heaven, the God of the universe, when we break His commandments, we have, in essence, begun to serve some other god, whether it be ourselves or something else that we are doing in the process. There are no commandments forbidding the killing of animals, fish, or birds. There are no commandments found in His law. But there is one against the unlawful taking of human life, as in abortions. I hope you see the point of that. They themselves have become God by throwing out His laws and by making brand new ones of their own. I probably should add here that that's not just necessarily a general statement on all of them, because there certainly may be some in those movements that are also concerned about the human baby that's being aborted as well. But I think that's probably the exception rather than the rule. And so generally it applies to nearly all of them. They have become First Commandment transgressors. And that, of course, leads us to the abortionists. They worship the quote-unquote sanctity of women's rights, don't they? Isn't that what they worship? Once again, as well, over God and His commandments. Clearly they do. And of course, they are already guilty of Sixth Commandment disobedience when they murder their children, or they murder someone else's. Here's another one that I'm certain would be considered in the obscure. And that is, have you ever considered Judaism as being First Commandment transgression? The worship of another god. Someone's sure to say, well, Judaism? How can you ever come up with Judaism as being First Commandment transgression? How in the world could that ever be First Commandment transgression? Well, let me tell you, it certainly is. Jews practicing Talmudic Judaism, and I've clarified it, I'm not necessarily talking about every one of them out there, but Jews practicing Talmudic Judaism worship that which was created. Jews practicing Talmudic Judaism worship that which was created. Anyone know what it is? No, that would be man's creation. So that they do worship the Talmud, and thus it would be idolatry. We're talking about First Commandment transgression. What is it created that they worship? themselves. First, they claim to be the Messiah. They reject Yahshua as Messiah, and they aren't looking, for the most part, for any other individual Messiah. They themselves claim to be the Messiah. Roland B. Gittleson, for example, in The Meaning of Judaism, wrote this. He first asked this question. He said, What do Jews believe about the Messiah? They do not expect Messiah to be the Son of God. Most non-Orthodox Jews hinge their hopes upon a messianic age than on an individual Messiah. Mr. Gittleson then quotes a rabbi as saying, there is a spark of Messiah in each of us, talking about the Jews only. There is a spark of Messiah in each of us. When we succeed in putting together all our individual sparks, the result will constitute the coming of the Messiah. Here's one maybe you haven't heard. Moses Hess, for example, who was probably the forefather of Zionism many, many, many years ago. Moses Hess, in his book Rome and Jerusalem, said, every Jew has the making of the Messiah himself. Every Jew has the making of a Messiah in himself. Every Jewish of a Mater Dolorosa in herself. Baruch Levi, in a letter to Karl Marx, simply stated, the Jewish people as a whole will be its own Messiah. And then we have what the Talmud says. If you want to nail it down about who the Jews believe the Messiah is, the Talmud does it. In Kuthaboth 111a, note number 4, it states, the throes of Mother Zion, which is in labor to bring forth the Messiah, without metaphor, the Jewish people. Their Messiah is clearly themselves. True Christianity now understands true Christianity, and I'll emphasize that no matter who may want to debate it. True Christianity understands the Messiah is God, or at the very least, that a part of God is the Messiah. Consequently, any group claiming to be the Messiah are in essence also claiming to be God, because you cannot be the Messiah without being God. But just so that there's no doubt where the Jews stand on this issue, Dr. Joseph Klausner, in the book The Messianic Idea of Israel, said, thus the whole people Israel, in the form of the elect of the nation, gradually became the Messiah of the world, the Redeemer of mankind. He then later identifies who the Jewish people believe the Redeemer is. Again, he says, the Jewish people, the elect of the nations, they are the Messiah, the Redeemer of mankind. And who does he say the Redeemer is? He says, quote, God alone is Redeemer, end quote. Consequently, if the whole people Israel, that is the Jews, become the Redeemer of mankind, and in their thinking the Redeemer is equivalent to God, then they are also claiming that the whole people Israel, quote unquote, are not only the Messiah, but God himself. Thus, how many people out here in Christianity today understand this? Thus, the Jews' God is not Yahweh. And across this land, that's what they believe, and that's what's being proclaimed. It's being said, well, they've got the same God that we do, at least. No, they don't. They never have had, at least from the time of the Babylonian captivity on, since the Talmud became their lifeblood, the circulating blood of their religion and their faith. Now, in light of that, also listen to the 1925 Jewish Encyclopedia. Listen closely to what this says. It says, it was the prophetic spirit of the Jewish nation embodied in Abraham, and then later it says, which transformed Yahweh, an original tribal deity localized on Sinai and connected with the celestial phenomena of nature, into a God of holiness. And then later, the moral governor of the world. They transformed Yahweh into the God of the universe. Now, how can they do that unless indeed he is only an idol to them and they as gods did the creating? And in the same vein, Moses Hess, again in Rome, in his book Rome and Jerusalem, wrote, Judaism would have shared in the fate of those offshoot religions, which he identified as Christianity and Mohammedism and Hinduism. He said, Judaism would have shared in the fate of those offshoot religions which froze into dogma and perished in the destructive conflict with modern science, were it not the creator of its own lofty concept of God? Were its religious teachings not the product of its own living experience? They were the creator. They claim that they were the creator of their own lofty concept of God. And who is their God? Not Yahweh. Here's the clincher. In the Jewish Kabbalah, it states, the Jew is the living God, God incarnate. He is the heavenly man. The other men are earthly of inferior race. They exist only to serve. You know, there can be no doubt. Judaism is first commandment transgression, according to the statute under consideration. For they worship the creature rather than the created. Excuse me, they worship the creature rather than the creator. And then lastly, under the obscure, we have Christian anarchists. And someone's probably to ask, well, what are Christian anarchists? Well, a Christian anarchist is a modern Christian who does away with God's law under the New Covenant and who at the same time substitutes God's laws with allegiance to man's or Caesar's law. And what determines who or what is our God? The God whose laws we keep. And if they've thrown out God's laws, and for the most part those who do that also substitute man's laws or Caesar's laws for Christians to be in allegiance to or subservience to, then they have indeed substituted and exchanged gods. Remember Matthew 6:24? Christ said, you cannot serve two masters, for you'll either hate the one and love the other or hold to one and despise the other. What's the end result of that kind of situation with modern Christianity? Modern Christian anarchists who throw away God's law and yet still promote their people, or on the other hand, promote and teach their people to be subservient to all of government's laws. What's the end result of that? We find it recorded very clearly in John chapter 19. You see, they'll probably end up claiming only Caesar as their master or their God, as they did there, and crucify the other. That's the end result. That is almost the inevitable end result of what's being proclaimed today by Christian anarchists. You know, when we serve and worship the creature rather than the creator, we may profess to be wise, but we're only fools, having exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for that which is corruptible, man and beast, in whatever form it may come. We have exchanged the truth of God for the lie, and we've broken the first commandment. Five first commandment statutes. We've looked at five first commandment statutes through this series. Taken two messages for every one, if you want to boil it down that way. But nonetheless, we've gone through, and it's become a lot much longer series than I ever expected. But as I dug into it, I found that there's a whole lot more to the first commandment than we ever expected before. Five first commandment statutes that fit under the first commandment. Number one, you shall not use the names of false gods in your speech. Number two, you shall form no unholy alliances, neither with the heathen nor with their gods. Number three, you shall not integrate with non-Israelites, especially heathen non-Israelites. Number four, you shall not fear anyone or anything besides God Almighty. And number five, you shall not worship the created, the creature, rather than the creator. Those five statutes help us to explain. And there you have it. And hopefully as a result, you've come to understand to a fuller meaning, to a deeper level, what the first commandment is really all about and how it's to be applied. But having studied, let me ask this, having studied and having elaborated upon the statutes of the first commandment, are we justified now in leaving the discussion about the first commandment? Well, certainly, hopefully, as a result of this long series, you understand the first commandment much better than you ever did before. But are we justified yet to leave it? Absolutely not. Remember, God's law is made up of three integral parts: the commandments, the statutes, and the judgments. Okay, you and I better understand the first commandment. And being Christians, out of love for our God, we will willingly obey it and apply it into our lives wherever we should. But how many more out there are there like you and me? And remember, we're only a remnant. Yahshua himself said, "The gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and few are those who find it." So what about the rest? What about those who are walking in the broad way, the majority? Those who are living ungodly, those who will have nothing to do with our God. Yes, we understand the first commandment. We want to apply the statutes which help explain it. We'll apply that into our lives willingly. But what about those who won't willingly do that? How do they fit into the picture? Now, I must be careful here, and that I want to make sure that it's understood that I believe that everyone should have the right to hear the gospel and to have the opportunity to be able to respond to Yahshua the Christ and His redeeming sacrifice. I believe everybody should have that opportunity, but let's face it, not everyone will. Again, Yahshua made it clear only a few will walk that path. And some will blatantly reject and blaspheme our God. And at the same time, they will at the same time attempt to even lead our children into the faith of false gods. Now, what about these? What is to be done with them under God's system of things? Where do they come into the picture again? Well, turn with me to 1 Timothy chapter 1, and I believe we'll find the answer. 1 Timothy chapter 1, I want to start with verse 8. Now first catch what it says in verse 8 here. It says, "But we know that the law is good." Now, I'm going to bring this up because I had a great debate with some Church of Christ people back when I was a Church of Christ preacher in Aurora. I had a great debate in the class of what law was being spoken of here. Now let me just ask you, I wish I had thought of this then, but do you think Paul, in writing to Timothy here, would have called Caesar's law good? Do you think he would have called Herod's law good? Do you think he would have called Pilate, the one who went ahead and allowed him to crucify our Christ? Do you think he would have called Pilate's law good? He might have said, "Well, this part of Pilate's law is good," or this statute of Herod's law is good, but there would have had to have been some explanation if he was talking about anything other than God's law here. And notice, look in your Bibles, notice that even the translators understood that he was talking about the Mosaic Law. Because of what this verse says, so many of those Christian anarchists out there, like I faced in that particular situation, want to say, "Well, this law, he's not talking about God's law. This is just any law." Well, not all law is good, people. So let's understand first that this is clearly talking about the Mosaic Law. He says, "But we know that the law is good if one uses it lawfully." Uses it lawfully when? He's not talking past tense. He's talking right now under the new covenant. That there's an unlawful use of the law, and there's a lawful use of the law under the new covenant. The new covenant, in other words, does not. Paul himself, as so many think that he does not do away with God's law under the new covenant. He says the law is good if one uses it lawfully, realizing the fact that the law was not made for a righteous man, but for those who are lawless and rebellious, for the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy and profane, for those who kill their fathers or mothers, for murderers and immoral men and homosexuals and kidnappers and liars and perjurers and whatever else is contrary to sound teaching according to the glorious gospel of the blessed God with which I have been entrusted. Now note here, it very clearly establishes that the law was made for the type of people that's identified in here. The murderers, the immoral, the homosexuals, the unholy, the profane, etc., etc. Very clearly it says the law was made for these type of people. Well, what part of God's law was made for these type of people? Were the commandments made for these type of people? Were the statutes made for these type of people? Not hardly. They've already proven that they aren't going to keep the commandments and statutes. What Paul is dealing with here is, consequently, the only part of the law that could apply to them. The judgments. the judgments apply to them. Under God's system, under a Christian civil body politic, the remnant, Christian Israel, would be in control of government. Now, I keep saying those things wrong. Will be in control of government. And I hope you get the point when I reemphasize it that way. Not would be, will be in control of government. With God's law, as found in the Scriptures, being their constitution. And either His commandments and statutes will be kept willingly out of love for God and fellow man, or they will be kept out of fear of the judgments. Turn, as proof for that, turn to Romans chapter 13. A passage that is totally distorted to say something it doesn't say at all. Romans 13. I want to read verses 1 through 4. And let me state before I read this that there is absolutely no question that with this passage that we are dealing with a Christian civil body politic, not just any form of government, as modern Christianity has tried to make it say. And as we get to verses 3 and 4, that's the proof. Verses 3 and 4 make it very clear. What is the form of government that's being described here? It is that Paul is describing a future Christian civil body politic, trying to get it into their heads. He's doing it very coy, because he's still got the ruling Roman government to have to contend with if he's not coy about it. If he's not as smart as a dove, wise as serpents and gentle as a dove. He's being wise as a serpent and gentle as a dove, but he still makes it clear what kind of civil body politic we're to be in subjection to. And verse 3 and 4 is specifically the proof and also what we want to center in on. Verse 1, let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause for fear for good behavior, but for evil. His day and age, and in ours, rulers are a fear many times for good behavior. It's just the opposite. So he's not describing the type of government we have today or the type of government Paul lived under then. He goes on, do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. Did the government then or the government today praise the doers of good? Not hardly. They usually crucified them back then, and they're planning probably to do sometime in the future for us today. So again, very clearly, he's talking about a different kind of civil body politic than preachers today are proclaiming this passage to describe. Verse 4, for it is a minister of God. Boy, you can sure call our government today a minister of God, can't you? I'm sure Paul would have certainly called that one then the minister of God. For it is a minister of God to you for good, but if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath upon the one who practices evil. What is evil? Evil is sin, is it not? And what is sin? 1 John chapter 3, verse 4. Sin is a transgression of God's law. So he's talking about this kind of civil body politic was to bring wrath down upon the one who had broken God's laws. He's talking about the judgments. The judgments that are to be applied. And if anybody wants further evidence, I've done a whole message that I think explains this passage so that there can be no doubt that this is talking about a Christian civil body politic that we're to be in subjection to. If you haven't heard the message, it's number T115. It's entitled Psalms 91:13 in light of Romans 13. Anyone on the tape ministry or hears this message is welcome to order that from me. Now, actually, there are three different options under this form of government described by Paul in this passage. There are three different options. One, you can keep the law from love or out of conscience sake. Two, you can keep the law from fear of the sword or the judgments. Or three, you can break the law and suffer the consequences of the judgments of God. Those are the three options. So, as a result of all of that, it should be clear to us that any study of God's commandments and statutes is incomplete without mention of the respective judgments as well. So, what is the judgment? Now we know that we need the judgments, that it's a part of God's whole scheme of His civil body politic when it's set up. And it's a part of his whole scheme. So what is the judgment for a First Commandment transgression? Or let's put it this way. What should be the judgment, for example, for someone who promotes prayer to Allah on behalf of this this country and our people? What's the judgment? Turn very clearly. It's described very clearly for us. There can be no question what the judgment should be. Deuteronomy chapter 13. Deuteronomy 13, verses 1 through 5. And if anyone questions whether our current form of government is the kind of government or civil body politic described by Paul in Romans 13, just ask yourself, would Congressman Nick Rahal have done what he did had our government been enforcing God's law, commandments, statutes, and judgment? Specifically, the judgment is found here in Deuteronomy 13, starting with verse 1. If a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes true concerning which he spoke to you, saying, "Let us go after other gods whom you have not known, and let us serve them," you shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams. For Yahweh your God is testing you to find out if you love Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul. People, before we read on, we failed the test. How many preachers did you hear rise up, and storm the gates of hell, either by letter or by newsletter or by message and tape? How many do you know that have rose up and showed their love for God and contested what went on last year in our Congress when they raised prayer to Allah by the black Muslim? I know of only two. One of them is right in front of you right now. Now, there may have been a few more, but you know it was a very, very small minority who did so. We failed the test. God says, I'm going to allow it to happen just so you can prove your love to me. And we failed the test. Verse 4, you shall follow Yahweh your God and fear Him and shall keep His commandments, listen to His voice, serve Him and cling to Him. Verse 5, but the prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death, because he has counseled rebellion against Yahweh your God, who brought you from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery, to seduce you from the way in which Yahweh your God commanded you to walk, so you shall purge the evil from among you. Clearly, First Commandment transgression, any of those five statutes disobeyed by the blatant, and again, some of us, there are many today who sometimes break some of those statutes without ever knowing it. But when we understand and we're accountable for the knowledge of knowing, and we blatantly go out and break any of those statutes or the First Commandment in itself, it's a capital crime, plain and simple. There's no way around it. That's the judgment of God. And how are they to be put to death? I think that needs to be understood as well. Turn to Deuteronomy 17. Deuteronomy 17, verses 2 through 7. Verse 2, it says, if there is found in your midst, in any of your towns, which Yahweh your God is giving you, a man or a woman who does what is evil in the sight of Yahweh your God by transgressing His covenant, and has gone and served other gods and worshipped them, or the sun or the moon or any of the heavenly host which I have not commanded, and if it is told you and you have heard of it, then you shall inquire thoroughly, and behold if it is true, and the thing certain that this detestable thing has been done in Israel, then you shall bring out the man or that woman who has done this evil deed to your gates, that is, the man or the woman, and you shall stone them to death. Going on, verse 6 and 7. On the evidence of two witnesses and three witnesses, he who is to die shall be put to death. He shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. The hand of the witnesses shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of the people. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. First of all, it had to be on the testimony of two or three witnesses. Any capital crime has to be on the testimony of two or three witnesses. And then the witnesses themselves are to pick up the first stones. But the punishment is death, and it's by stoning. And I don't believe that was ever to be changed as well. We'll deal with that. I'm probably the next series of messages I'm going to deal with is probably on capital punishment, because I think it's probably needs to be addressed after this last message of this series. So we'll deal with that in more detail. Nonetheless, we can see here that First Commandment transgression was punishable by death, specifically by stoning. And for those, again, who may think that, of course, this only applies to the Old Covenant times, we've got Luke 19, verse 27, as proof that indeed it applies to this time as well. In the parable of the talents, with the noblemen in that parable clearly representing Yahshua the Christ, Yahshua says, "But these enemies of mine, who did not want me to reign over them, to be their king or their god, bring them here and slay them in my presence." First commandment, disobedience or transgression, is to be punished by death when it's blatant and when they have refused to repent and serve our God through Yahshua the Christ and His sacrifice. And so now you have the whole picture. Boy, you heard him. We're going to have a message on First Commandment, on the First Commandment. You thought it'd be one message, but there's been a whole lot more to First Commandment, to the First Commandment, than we ever anticipated. There was the five statutes that help us to explain and understand them, the application of those five statutes in today's society, and then the judgment that needs to be carried out as well. The First Commandment, are we keeping it? You know, I'm convinced that for most today, they'd probably say yes, at least prior to this series of messages, if they're going to hear it. They'd probably say yes. But, you know, it can only truly be determined with a thorough examination of the statutes and the judgments which belong to the First Commandment as well. In closing this series, I say to you, as Moses once said to our early Israelite forefathers, "Hear, O Israel, Yahweh is our God, Yahweh is one. And you shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. Let it be only Him whom we love, whom we worship, whom we serve, and whom we fear." Let's stand and we'll close in prayer. Our God Almighty, we come before You this morning humbly. Lord, humbly looking to You as the Creator and Sustainer of the universe, the Almighty, Omnipotent, Omniscient, Omnipresent, God, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Father, we come before only You to worship and serve You, to praise and to magnify Your name, to love You and serve You and even fear You. Lord, forgive us when we do fall short, when we get selfish ourselves and remove You from the throne of our life and place either ourselves or something else of importance there. Help us to repent when those things happen, Father, knowing that there is grave consequence to be incurred when we do so. We do worship You, and we just pray, Father, that there will be a revival in our land once again unto You and to Your laws, to Your commandments, statutes, and judgments, and that once again we might take dominion and take it on behalf of Yahshua and His sacrifice for us. We praise You now, and we offer these tapes and these messages is a sacrifice unto You to be used on this behalf. We praise You, Yahshua the Christ.